Okay, I want to thank the readers, and now let's give a warm welcome to our warm-up speaker, Pat.
Hi, my name is Pat. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the newcomer. My sobriety date is January 2nd, 2005. It was not a New Year's resolution. I'm half Native American. I'll give you a little brief history. My mom's full-blooded Native American. She left my dad when I was 5. I didn't see her again until I was 30. She never tried to contact me, and I really was confused all my life growing up, like, where is this woman? But when I did find her when I was 30, it was 4th of July. VFW picnic. She was with a friend of hers, and they had this probably, I'm thinking a half a gallon bottle of vodka that was almost gone. It was then that I realized, you know, there's a lot of alcohol in her story. She died at the age of 56, alcohol-related diseases in 1996. My brother also, she had two children, myself and my brother, and he also had problems with alcohol at a young age, and the kind of person that would drink out of brown paper bags, and he actually was the train hopper and, you know, was arrested a lot, you know, found in the gutters of Stockton. In fact, when they found him, he had just gotten released from DBI. This was in 2003. By some railroad tracks under a bridge. I mean, that can kind of give you a picture. That's what I thought alcoholics were, was that, and that I thought I was not an alcoholic. I got my first DUI in 2003, 0.2. I was in a blackout. I thought somebody put something in my drink, and that it wasn't my fault. I did the whole court card thing, had to do a weekend in jail, paid all my fines, I got it all behind me, and tried to forget it, like everything else that happened in my life that I had done wrong. I changed where I drank. I changed what I drank. I made sure I didn't leave my drink. If I did, it was like beer with hot so that I could leave. Or I would finish my drink before I went to the bathroom. But I still was convinced that somebody put something in my drink. My son had confronted me one time and said, "Mom, you're not very attractive when you're drinking." And, you know, that when a family member says something like that to you, I just shrugged it off, like, well, I'm not trying to be attractive, you know, and I went out anyway. That was my only response. So, I had to do a 6-month alternative services program, I had to do 12 meetings at AA, and all the meetings I went to, I sat in the back, and I tried to do 12 different meetings, because I did not want to get to know you. But that was the same year my brother passed away, and I honestly did not drink for 2 weeks. I was so mad at alcohol, what it had done to him. But then I picked it up again, because, you know, how we are. I had been divorced twice. I kind of get back to that, but I was, had alcoholism, you know, all my growing up. My drinking became really heavy after the second divorce. So after that second DUI in 2003, I changed where I drank, watched where I went. By October of 2004, I was starting to get in trouble at work. I had gotten a letter that my behavior was unacceptable at our year-end meeting. And before I even could finish that letter that I got in the mail, I was at work when I got it. I had turned around and threw it in the shredder, and I thought, this is wrong. you don't know me. You know, it's like, you don't know me or why. I was just so angry at it. Before I even, I was shredding it, and I was like, wait a minute, I want that back. You know, I want to read that again. And I, the two people I was partying with, they got letters, and I made them send me a copy because I wanted to chew over it some more. But that was a horrible night. I lost my car keys in the snow. I was out in naked snow angels out when everybody was sleeping in their hotel room. You know, I was when I look back on it, I thought that was totally unacceptable. But I did not think it was unacceptable at the time. It was like, why aren't these people alive and waking up and want to party? This is a year-end party, you know. It's a work year-end party. So, that was October. By December, I mean, nothing's changed about my thinking. It was the same or maybe even getting worse. I was kind of concerned about it, and it was the time where I would always think about, should I go to the bar, should I just go home? Should I go to the bar, should I just go home? And I always talk myself into going to the bar. You know, I'm just going to have one. And this night in particular, I should go home. And I went to the bar, and I had, you know, I was going to Applebee's now instead of the pump house. You know, I left it up a little. So I had like two tall ones, or maybe three, and a short one, and somebody gave me a shot, and I had a short one to go, and then I went home, and it's a Tuesday night, it was the week after Christmas, and I got dressed, and I drank while I was at home, and I went out. That was typical. That was just a typical night. I'm trying to do something different, and never was going to go different. That's just how it was. And I left the bar at 1 in the morning and drove home. I don't remember going through McDonald's. I don't remember. All I remember was the lights coming on. And I'm sure they shined them in my rearview mirror because all of a sudden I woke up and I came to and I was like, oh my God. I was just sick. You know, I just kind of came to knowing I'm in trouble. I'm not getting out of this one. My future was flashing before my eyes. Got pulled over, tried to park right, I didn't. I got tires on the curb when I looked at it the next day. But it was the cop who looked at me, and I felt like a little kid being scolded, and he says, do you have a drinking problem? And I didn't say anything. Because deep down inside, I knew I had a drinking problem. I knew I needed my life. I wasn't going anywhere. I had no direction. I didn't know who I was as a person. Then he proceeded to tell me, I'm the one who arrested you the first time. Handcuffed me, put me in the back of the car. I didn't want to do the breathalyzer because I thought, oh my God, I can't. I just left tomorrow. I kind of knew that. Don't do that. I was pre-planning, go get blood, because maybe that'll waste some time. I don't remember getting the blood, but they took me, you know, booking and all that. And so the next day, and that was like December 29th, and that weekend came over New Year's, and I rented four movies, and I was going to stay home and watch movies. I was depressed. My son talked me into, don't drive. Go out, go drive, get a taxi, you know. That's what people that still drink tell you to do. They don't want to tell you don't drink. They want to tell you what's the right thing to do. Don't drive and drink. So I went out, because I really wanted to go out. And I went out and I drank and I drove. And I got home, I didn't get in trouble, I didn't get pulled over. But I drank and I drove again. And I just went in such a deep depression that next week. It was actually January 2nd when I didn't drink that day, and I called a hotline from work, an EAP hotline, and the guy said, after bawling and wailing all my troubles and what just happened to me, and wanted somebody to feel sorry for me, and he said, do 90 minutes in 90 days, because I'm an alcoholic. And then he got me some outside counseling. I went to a meeting. I sat in this chair by the door in the back. But the girl at the table waved me front, and I went. And I sat there, and she gave me a meeting list, and she circled the meetings that she goes to, and I went to those meetings. I started to do everything they suggested because I was sick and tired of what I was doing, and I just hated myself. When we got to the part of doing the amends, I thought I was the biggest one on my list. I couldn't stand myself. I was crying at every meeting. They had a box of Kleenex with my name on it because they knew I was going to cry. And the people that were at that meeting remember, you know. And I went to a lot of meetings. I just went to a lot of meetings. I took that 90-day thing, you know, 90 meetings and 90 days serious. And life started to get better. There was fun. The girls that, you know, gravitated toward me in the beginning, they're still my friends today. They know me better than anybody. Know me better than my family. My dad, my stepmom, they don't know anything that's happened to me. I don't live in the same town. They don't need to know. You know, what they see today, my kids know this program just turned my life around. They are, can't even tell me enough how much they're blessed. And sometimes I feel like I don't deserve it. But it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed. You know, I had a choice. I'm sure to go. You know, I've had disappointments and I've had hard times and I've had really good times. And even though the tough times were hard, I think the thing I remember most about them was I called my sponsor. And I called a couple more friends. And not to isolate. And to keep going to meetings and to get into service and to keep a sponsor. And I learned that life happens. And I learned to let go and let God. And that's my 10 minutes. I am so grateful for this program. And like I said, welcome to the newcomer. If you're here, you're here for a reason. So that's all I got. Thank you.
Let's give a warm round of applause to my friend, Kim.
Hello, everyone. My name's Ken, and I'm an alcoholic. And, yes, aloha. Some of you that know me might know I have more than one addiction. I'm kind of addicted to Hawaii, too. But, you know, I'm honored to be here. I'm honored to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's always a pleasure to try and be able to do something, to something to save my life. You know, it not only saved my life, it gave me a life worth living today. You know, actually, I was just thinking a while ago, it's amazing. It only took me about 2 years to get to these rooms. I never really drank when I was a kid. I think once or twice I drank. I had something to drink when I was a kid. I didn't start drinking until I got into the Navy. You know, when I got into the Navy, I was in boot camp, and everybody said that, you know, they were talking about what they were going to do, and all they said was, I'm going to get drunk and I'm going to get laid. And, you know, I'm 18 when I got into boot camp, and I got on the airplane coming home. Now, I was the kind of kid that grew up with an alcoholic home. My family, they had money for booze, but not for our kids. You know, we never seen a doctor or a dentist unless it was an emergency. We went to school with hand-me-down clothes. I had holes in my shoes and put cardboard in my shoes. You know, it's... So, I never really had, and at school, you know, I used to run around with some friends, and they used to say, you know, you're always over at our house. How come you never invite us to yours? And I never knew what to expect when I got home, you know. And at any rate, I felt I was an introvert, you know. I always felt less than. I didn't feel like I was accepted by anybody else. And I lived like that for a long time until I started drinking. And, you know, I found out that booze was kind of a lifesaver for me. because when I got on that airplane coming home from boot camp, before I got off onto my next duty station, you know, I got on the airplane and, I'm 18, and the airline stewardess came by and said, "You're allowed two drinks. What would you like to have?" I said, "I'm too young to drink." She said, "Well, you got a uniform on, there's a war going on, and we're up in the air, you can have anything you want." And I said, I'm not thinking to myself, I don't know what to order. On TV, they drink martinis. So I ordered a martini, and you know, I hated the damn thing. But you're allowed to, so I had one more. And, but it was a champagne flight, and the lady happened to be from Indiana, and that's where I'm from. So every time she'd walk past me, she'd make sure that my glass was all the way filled up. Now, I'm a shy kid, and you know, I felt less than. I didn't go to the junior or senior prom. I didn't ask anybody to do anything. And those few drinks I had at that time, I had the airline stewardesses were sitting on my lap. They were taking pictures. I was a different person, you know. And so, you know, I thought that's my answer. You know, when I was getting off the plane, my buddies were trying to carry me off the plane, put my foot up against the door, and they said, "You're going to get us all in trouble." And I said, "These ladies promised me a kiss, and I'm going to get one before I get off the plane." So, you know, that was my answer to my problems when I was, and I drank all the time. And like I said, when I was a kid growing up and being raised the way I was, I swore I'd never drink. And I can remember on two different occasions, I was so mad. And I screamed at my parents and said, "I'll never drink because I'll never raise my kids the way you raised us." You know, my dad hit me in the face one time. I was late coming home from baccalaureate practice 3 weeks before graduation. And I fell down on he took us from the city and put us in this little basement. He built a basement and we're going to build a house on top of it the next year. That never happened. And so I was raised in this little basement and had concrete floors. And when he hit me, I fell on the floor right next to a beer bottle that had the neck broke off. Could have went right through me. And he told me to get out of the house. And he said, "I don't ever want to scream." Actually, he was beating the hell out of me. And my mom tried to stop him. He pushed my mom and she couldn't. She hit her spine and she couldn't walk for 3 days. And I got up and I pushed him and I said, "You can hit me all you want, but leave her alone." He said, "You get out of the house and I don't want you in here. I don't ever want to see you on our property again." And so, you know, that's kind of the way I was raised. I mean, I'm kind of jumping around. I'm not used to speaking, but you know, this is a part of my sobriety. And I just want to do my best to show the people that, you know, there is hope in these rooms. When I got here, I had none, you know, because I've been in and out of these rooms since I was 20. I told you it took me about 2 years to get into these rooms. You know, I got into the Navy, and I, like I said, that was my first drunk, but I drank all the time after that. And I was always getting in trouble, and so, you know, by the time I was 20 years old, I had already been, I was placed into a Navy hospital. I had went over the hill. I'd done just three campaigns over in Vietnam, and they were going to send me back again, and I said, "You can't do that." And they said, "Sure we can. We can do whatever we want to do." I said, "I did my time over there. I'm not going back." They said, "You don't have a choice." So, you know, I went to the chaplain. I went to the old man. I went to a lot of people, and nobody said they could help me, so I just left, you know. And the only idea I had was my military ID, so I didn't want to get in trouble and get with the law, so I went down and lived with the winos. And so, you know, this is at the age of 20 years old, you know, and that's when I learned that I could stay in missions, you know. And, you know, it's just amazing. I was an alcoholic from the beginning. You know, at any rate, I'm with them, and somebody said I'd get in trouble I'd be considered a deserter because I was gone 23 days. So I went and turned myself into it was in San Bernardino. I turned myself into the base there, and they put me in jail, and I started shaking, just trembling. And the guy looked at me, and he says, "What's wrong with you?" And so he told this other guy, and they said, "Well, get him an aspirin." So he gave me a cup of water and some aspirins, and I'm shaking that up, going into the DTs. And so they, they took me, this armed guard took me to the hospital, and they gave me some formaldehyde, and they gave me three shots, three injections. And the lady, I can remember the nurse telling this guy, "You don't have to be here. He ain't going nowhere with what we give him." He said, "Well, I have to be here. It's the law." So during that night, whatever they gave me wasn't enough, because I started hallucinating, and I really went nuts. So they had to come in and give me a couple more shots. And the next day, they put me in an ambulance and took me from San Bernardino to the Naval Station and Naval Hospital in Long Beach. They put me in this little glass room because I was shaking so bad. They put this little ball in my hand. They said, "If any of these tubes come out, squeeze this ball, because you might bleed to death." And that's why I was in this glass room, because I couldn't hold on to the ball. I was shaking so much. I was in there for 2.5 days, but I was in intensive care for 10 days. And I kept telling myself, that this chief came by and he said, "You're probably going to go to jail, or the brig it is, or you can go to this treatment center we just started in Long Beach at the Naval Station." And he said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I don't know." Well, I sure as hell didn't want to go to jail, but I didn't know what to tell him, And so he said, "Well, I'll be back tomorrow, and you better have an answer by then." So I went to this Naval Station. So that was my first treatment center at the age of 20. I thought I was too young to be an alcoholic, but I'd already been selling blood. Because of the Navy don't pay me enough for my habit. I'm an alcoholic. I like to drink. So I've been in and out of these rooms since I was 20. I've been in eight VA hospitals and went through their treatment program for alcoholism. One of those eight I went through five times in San Francisco at Fort Myers. And I've been in and out of these rooms. Just before I moved up here, I forgot about a detox, and I went to this detox three times, and I was actually doing H&I work there before I moved here. They had to take me from there and take me to the hospital because I was going through the DTs while I was there. I'm one of those kind of guys that needed hospitalization when I got sober. I can't say enough about these rooms. I've went through a lot. I know that when I've come into these rooms in the past and I hear people with tragic stories and stuff, and I used to think to myself, "My God, if that happened to me, I'd quit too." But you know what? I went back out, and worse things happened to me. I can remember after I left that treatment center in Long Beach, when I said I thought I was too young to be an alcoholic, I went home. I went to jail three times in 2 weeks just for being public drunk. That's what they did to you in Indiana. The second time I seen the judge, he said, "Weren't you just here?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, if I see you again in six months, I'm going to give you 6 months at the State Farm, which is the state prison in Indiana." That same weekend, I'm back in jail again. And it's a holiday weekend, and all these guys in the jail tease me because I'm going to prison. And I didn't think it was funny at all. So I got to the courtroom, and there was a different judge. The other one was on vacation or something. He said, "I haven't got any paperwork on you. Have you ever been here before?" And I said, "No, sir, Your Honor." So I left town, and I left town and went to Muncie, Indiana, 40 miles away, and got drunk with my uncle. And that was a weird feeling when I woke up, because when I woke up, I seen bars. I'm all by myself, and all I see is bars. I was in a blackout. I have no idea why I'm in jail or what happened. Nothing. Nobody's there to say anything or to tell me anything. And that's a scary feeling. That my aunt told me they had just started a program at the Veterans Hospital in Marion, Indiana, which was a mental hospital for veterans, actually. and they had this started this substance abuse program and alcoholic program at the hospital, and they had just started, so they didn't know what to do with you when you first got there. So they, when I got there, my aunt said it looked good when I seen the judge if I went there first. So I went there, and so they put you in this with all these nuts, all these mental patients in a locked ward. And these people are banging their heads on the wall and they're going nuts, and I really was nuts by the time I got out of there. It kept me there for 13 days before I got into the program. But you know, I got into the AA then, and this is a funny story. After I stayed sober for 6 months after that, so they asked me to come back and speak so that the people, the patients there, because they had outside AA and patients both come into the same room, and they'd have a speaker each twice a week. So they asked me to come so that people would know that it worked. And so I come in there, and I didn't want to. I was scared. I'm scared tonight. But they had a podium like this, and I'm standing up there, and back there you had to wear a suit and tie or something, so I had to go out and get a sport coat. I'm standing there, and I talked for 7 minutes, and the podium shook so much it went clear over to the other side of the room. And some guy came over and tapped me on the shoulder and said, I'll finish up for you. That was in 1970. But you know, it's crazy because I got in here and I was doing what you people told me to do. I got involved with meetings. I started setting up meetings, making coffee. I started doing intergroup. I started doing a lot of things. And I was a part of AA at that time. And I was in these rooms for 2.5 years, and I really, in my mind, I thought I would never drink again. But you know, I thought I was doing everything right, but then I met this lady, and she wasn't in the rooms. And she used to say, what makes a difference whether you're sober or not? You're never home. Because I had commitments and I was doing things. So one by one, I quit doing those things. And pretty soon, I quit doing the meetings, and I would quit doing the things that was keeping me sober. And pretty soon, when things didn't work out with me and her, I'm gone. And I was the kind of drunk that's a runner, you know, and whenever I run, the bottle goes with me. And I laid awake all night talking to God one night, and I said, you know, I was into self-pity. And I couldn't sleep, couldn't eat, and I thought my world ended because we split up, you know. And so I told God, I said, I can't live like this anymore. I said, I'm going to drink. And I know I'm going to get drunk, but I can't, I don't know what else to do. And so I said, I don't want my friends to see me like this. So I went and I drove to, I was going to drive out to California. And I waited till I get across the state line, and I got into Missouri, and I keep driving and driving. I want to find a bar that's right next to a motel because I don't want to drive while I'm drinking because I know I'm going to get drunk. And I finally found one, and I just, last time I seen said 63 miles to Springville or Springfield or something. Anyways, I pulled over here and I got this, and it was just a little town. And I got the room, and I went to this bar, and I started drinking, and said, this ain't no fun here. I said, where's another bar? They said, up there. So I drove up there, and that was not my kind of bar. I don't love her, not a fighter. These people were trying to kill each other in that bar up there. They were breaking beer bottles and going after each other, and I said, for getting me out of here. So I was going back down the mountain, and it was raining, and I drove my car right off the Ozark Mountain. This is the very first drunk I had after I left Alcoholics Anonymous, and tree trunk stopped me from going all the way down. So you know, when they say you don't get any better, they don't lie. You know, and that was my first drunk. 11 months later, I'm in Portland, Oregon, and at the VA hospital, and they took a piece of my liver out, and they did a liver biopsy on me because they thought I was jaundiced, because my eyes was yellowish. And so, you know, it didn't get any better for me. So from there on, you know, I had two different doctors. Then they came in to me. One was a man and one was this lady, and at different times. And they said, you know, booze is killing you. So this isn't the first time I heard this. But they said, booze is killing you. And I said, they said, you should smoke pot. I said, I don't like pot. They said, we smoke pot. And I said, I don't like pot. It makes me go to sleep. And so So I left there and I got back into AA, and you know, I stayed sober for a year and a half in Seattle. And you know, I did the same thing over again. I guess I got a hard head. Put somebody in front of my sobriety and it just don't work. You know, you know, when they say it gets worse, it sure does in my case. I know that I led that demoralizing life, that pitiful and demoralizing life for a lot of years. I was on the road. I was from the East Coast to the West Coast. I found out I can't hold a job. I've had hundreds of jobs from Florida to California and Washington and all over. And because of my drinking, you know. Either they fire me or I quit because I'd rather drink or whatever the reason was. And so I finally found out that, you know, if I couldn't afford to pay rent one time, and this was back in Indiana too. A friend of mine had a game out there. He was running a carnival game. So I went out there and asked him for a job. My rent was only $15 a week for a pretty nice little apartment. This was back in 70, I don't know when. And I went to him and said, can I get a job with you? And he said, all my family's working for me. I ain't got no room for you. But he went and got the owner of the show. And so that was my start with the carnival. You know? So I started giving away teddy bears for love affairs. And you know, it's amazing because my first day of work, I'm standing there and I'm from 10 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock in the morning, and they came by and I get 1/4 of everything I bring in. And so the guy came in and he said, let me have your money, and I handed it to him. He got mad. He threw it in my face and said, go get something to eat. I'd made $4 in 13 hours of work. My cut was $1. So he didn't say he'd give it all to me. So the next day, the owner comes by, the owner of the game, and said, what do? You just stand here and wait for people to come to you like a store clerk? He said, you got to make some noise and let them know you're here. I'll get a few drinks in me and I can go nuts. So I made a lot of noise and I started making a lot of money. And that was my nick in life. I was making more money than the people who had been there 10 or 15 years. And so I found out that wherever I'm at, I can go to a carnival, there's one in town, and I can get a job. And you know, that's another story. That's for another day. But you know, I got to San Francisco, and you know, that's where I got sober this time. I was sober in Arizona for about a year. I went through the VA. I got into a halfway house, and then I went up to Prescott, Arizona, and went through their alcoholism program. I stayed sober for about a year at that time. But when I got to San Francisco, I went there because I had an aunt that was working in a hotel, and so I at any rate, I started working at a hotel, and it was a decent hotel. And I'd come home, and I'd have to walk by this bar, and I'd stop by this bar, and I'd stop by this bar, and this lady one night, she said, I see you coming in here. But she says, you know, I don't know any of them. It was not the best area of town. And she said, I don't know any of you out of here. She said, would you stay here with me? And I said, I don't have the money. She says, I'll buy you a drink. Don't worry about it. So that was my first enabler there in San Francisco. And by the way, she died of this disease at the age of 35. But she made sure that I'd go back. And it's actually the guy who owns that bar, particular bar, the 21 Club, who brought me to the hospital when I was going through the DTs this last time, and I got sober this time. I got sober in September of 1993 this time. And, you know, it's just amazing the life I've had since I got sober. But at any rate, you know, this lady, she was my enabler, and then I found other enablers there. And I could go to that bar, I could go to the Siemens bar across the street, And I could knock on the door at 5 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning, and they let me in. Like I said, I had enablers. And it's the only reason I stayed in that town, because, like I said, I'm a runner. I always was on the go somewhere. And so at any rate, the guy who owns the bar, one time I started swamping the bar, and the bartender looked at me one day and said that, you know, Frank's marking these bottles. Said, because I was drinking, by then I was drinking bourbon and water. And so he's marking these bottles, you know, because he knows that you've been drinking. He wants to know how much you've been drinking while you're here all by yourself. And so, but she started laughing. She said, and I know that when you come in, you're drinking coffee with brandy. So, and I, that's not bourbon. So, but when I found out that he was marking the bottles, well, I always drink the cheap stuff. So that's why he was marking. So I just started drinking the high, the top shelf stuff, because he didn't mark them. So I was drinking the good bottles. But you know, like I said, I was going. I'm going to get into the good part now. I got home. You know, I was in this. I don't know. I was in a terrible state. You know, for a long time. My last few years of drinking, what consisted of being at home, going to the bars and drinking all day, and then somehow I had this job at this hotel. And I had probably had it as long as I did anything. I managed to stay in the Navy for 2 years, 9 months, and 7 days. And I think I was in this hotel for 4 years, but they fired me 9 times in that 4 years. But nobody wanted to work there, because even the women had knife fights in the lobby there. I mean, it was not a safe place to work. One time, after I got sober, I had to still stay there because I didn't have nowhere else to go. I was coming down to go to work, and when I heard some pops, you know, I didn't know if it was firefighters or what, where I lived, and I come down to the lobby, and there's people in yellow tape and cops everywhere, and the cop grabbed me and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to work. He said, you're not going out that door. There was a dead body laying up against the door there, and another one in the middle of the street. You know, but I had to walk around then to get to I had to go out the fire to get to work. You know, and I ended up staying there for a year and a half after I got sober. And it was bad enough being drunk living there, you know. And I don't know. You know, I guess the thing of it is if I had listened to you people when I was 20 years old and did what you guys were telling me, and make sure my sobriety was safe first, I wouldn't have had to go through any of that, you know? But I didn't. I had to do what I had to do. You know, when I started getting sober this time, you know, there was a couple of times I really wanted to quit. You know, I'd be sitting on that bar stool, always sat at the corner bar, windows on each side, and I'd watch people going to work in the morning, and they got their briefcases, they're going down to get on the train or whatever they have to do, and I just wish I could be one of them. I just wish I had, so I could get out of that place. I shook so much every day that I couldn't write. I couldn't fill out an application. And after I had a couple of drinks, and I didn't want to. And so, and you know, if you think that I didn't have some kind of faith in Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I didn't think it would work for me, I'm sitting there with my bourbon and water, and two guys come into the bar, and they're talking, I mean, from the moment they hit the door, they're just talking bad about Alcoholics Anonymous, saying bad things, and I looked at them, what's wrong with you, I said. I said, there's nothing wrong with AA. I said, it'll work. And they're looking at me with my bourbon and water, and I said, you just got to want it. And the bartender walks down to me, and she says, what about you? And I said, I'm not ready yet. You know? So I must have had some kind of thoughts about Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, when I got sober this time, I, like I said, I had those thoughts. I just didn't, that pitiful, demoralizing life, I just was so sick of it. I'd sit there and I'd think about ways to die or ways to, where AA or whatever was going through my mind. And finally, I had to hold on to things to get to the bathroom. And I looked in the mirror and I looked like death warmed over. My eyes were back in my socket and my face was grayish. And I said out loud, I said, God, is this how I'm going to die too? You know, because my enablers were dying. And I used to sit on the bar stool and wonder, what am I going to do now? Anyway, I just got on my knees and I asked God for help. I didn't do anything else. I don't know what I said, but I asked God for help. And all I did was get back into bed. And somehow, sometime after that, the phone rang and I answered the phone. And it was the guy I told you about that owns the bar, the 21 Club. And he said, get yourself together. I'm going to take you to the hospital. I don't want you dying like our friends. And so that's how I got here. He took me to the emergency room at Fort Miley, and I was going through the DTs again, and once again I'm back in their treatment center there. You see, I didn't come to AA. I didn't go to anybody and ask for help. I just asked God for help, and it just happened. So that's why I always feel like God brought me back to these rooms. And I really think it's these rooms that keeps me close to my God and keeps me close to you and Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I got into these rooms, and it's amazing because they let me back in the hospital, because I was there in September, and they told me that they put me back in the same place two times in the same year. That's a miracle in itself. But in September, I had this lady who was she was in charge of outpatient, and she was in charge of the substance abuse and alcohol program there. And she was telling me, you got to go to outpatients, you got to do this, and you got to do that. And I looked at her and I said, I don't have to do any of that. All I have to do is go to AA because it kept me sober before. And she kept insisting. I said, no, I don't need that. So in January, when they let me out of there, and I went home, I started thinking to myself, I don't know anybody in AA, so I'll just go back to the bar and I'll just drink juice. That lasted for about 3 days. And then then 9 months later, I'm back in the hospital with the DTs. And then back inside that program. And thankfully, they let me back in. So when they asked me to go to a halfway house this time, I said, okay. Now, without that booze in me, I'm that scared little boy that's still in high school that don't know how to be around people. And I was like that for a long time, even in sobriety. But anyway, I went to this halfway house, and I'm scared. I don't know how to get around these people, and I'm just starting to get used to them, you know. They called me into the office one day, about this time of year. It was 5 days before Christmas, and they said, we're going to move you to another house. I said, no. I said, I just started to get used to these people. I said, I can't do it again. They said, well, we're going to do it anyway. And I said, I didn't do anything wrong. And they said, well, that's okay. We're going to do it. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, I was going to outpatient at that time, and this was out by the ocean, and I had to walk through Golden Gate Park, or I could take a bus. And it's kind of a rainy day after when they told me this, and I didn't know what I was just in a dilemma. And so I'm walking through Golden Gate Park. It's kind of rainy out, but I wanted to walk because I wanted to talk to God. And I'm walking through the woods, and I'm saying, I believe. And I said, I think I believe. And I said, well, if I think I believe, I don't really believe. But then I said, but I'm willing to believe. And I my head was just jumbled, but God knew I was talking to him. And so when I got across to the other side of the woods, I could see a little bit of sunlight coming through the limbs of the trees. And when I got past the trees, I looked up and I seen a rainbow. And you know, I seen that rainbow, I just got a warm feeling inside, like it's okay. Everything's going to be okay. And that rainbow has been, it just means a lot to me. And and it has been okay since then. I haven't found it necessary to run or to drink or do anything else since then. But you know, it doesn't mean that everything is a bed of roses because I got sober. I got in here and I started going to a lot of meetings, and I started doing what you people were doing. And I was scared. I didn't talk much at all for over a year and a half, 2 years. But, you know, and I got a settlement. You know, I walked out of this halfway house after I'd seen that rainbow and stuff. I just decided I'm not going to do this anymore. I had a candy bar, a pack of cigarettes, and I think $1 or $2 to my name. That's it. And I lost my place to go. I didn't have nowhere to go when I walked out of there. And I walked down there to where the train is. And I got on that train and those bars in the front, I'm just squeezing them. And I'm talking to God, and I said, God, I said, you know, if I'm homeless, I don't know how to survive out there unless I drink. And I said, I don't want to drink. And, you know, I stayed in somebody's floor that night. The next day, they gave me a place to stay at the hotel where I was working before. And I was staying in an out-of-order room for a week until they talked the owner into giving me my job back. No money, just a place to sleep. And I worked one day a week or 2 days, whatever it was. But at least it kept me off the street. And so this guy who kept me off the street is the manager, supervisor of the hotel. You know, I got a settlement from the government after a year and a half. And all this time, you know, I'm picking up cigarettes left off the street. I'm just too proud to ask somebody for a cigarette. And so at any rate, I get this settlement from the government, so I'm going to go on a trip. Guess where? Hawaii. So anyways, I'm going to go on this trip, and my boss says, well, you don't want to be broke when you come back. He said, leave your money here. Just take what you need when you go. So he said, you got a safe deposit box here. And nobody can get to it but me and the owner and yourself. So I put $2,500 in there, and then I took off for Hawaii. So when I came back, that money's gone. You know, and I just, first it was anger, but mostly it was hurt. You know, because I didn't trust anybody when I got sober. Not anybody. But I had a little trust for him because he kept me off the streets. You know, and it hurt. You know, and then I found out he was embezzling from the owner and a lot of other people too. So, but it didn't. But you know, the important part was that I came to these rooms, and when I got to these rooms, I listened to what you people were saying. And I used to go to a 9 a.m. meeting in San Francisco, and that's funny too, because it was called the Niners, and I knew it because of the 49ers. I had no clue because it was 9 o'clock in the morning. But at any rate, I'd seen this guy there, and after this happened, and I went to him, and I said, would you go have coffee with me? You know? And first of all, before we went and happened, you know, I talked with God, and I did a little mini inventory about it, and then I went and talked to somebody. And I learned that from listening to you people in these rooms. And you know, it seems like by saying it, it takes some of the power out of the hurt. You know, so a lot of wonderful things happened to me in my life, but it's not always been good, you know. But I got through it. That's the important thing. You know, a lot of the things that I used to dream about or fantasize about, they've come true in my life today. You know, I have a family, I have friends. I have a lot of friends. And I didn't, things I never had. When I was out there drinking. You know, they always say never quit before the miracle happens. And I used to think when I got sober this time, what if I didn't run the last time? What if I would have stuck around and went through whatever it was I was going through? But you know, it took what it took to get me here. One of the things that happened, you know, I used to go to this meeting to try and overcome my fear. And there would be over 500 people every Tuesday night at the Knob Hill at this church. And they had two meetings. They had one at 7 o'clock, and it went to 7:45 or something. And they had one with a featured speaker. And I used to go to that just to try and overcome my fear. You know, and I one day this gal, I've seen her there. Or actually, she seen me. And she came up and she threw her arms around me, and she said, "I got 10 days now." This is the same girl who was a stripper at several different clubs there. And she used to come into the bar every day, and every now and then she would quit drinking. And she'd come up to me and say, "I have come and drank for X amount of days, and I feel great. You should try it." I said, "I'm not interested." And so she'd come in and she'd say, "I got 23 days, or however long it was. You should quit too." And I said, "No." At any rate, she always started back drinking again. Anyway, she came up to me and she said, "I got 10 days. 2 weeks later, she walked out of a bar across the street from the post office and somebody shot her and killed her. So, I mean, you never know what's going to happen to you when you leave these rooms. I have a friend. I have a friend that was very close to me in Hawaii. He had 78 years in this program. He had worked for Hawaiian Airlines for 20 years and he went back out. He's not with us anymore. You know, I have friends who went out. I don't see him, so I don't know what happened to him. But you know, I'm just blessed that I'm here. So the things that's happened to me. You know, one of the things that I didn't tell you earlier when I was with these carnivals, I left one of my jobs in San Francisco and I went to Monterey with this big Indian, and him and his lady were going to get married, and that didn't work out. So we ended up in his sister's garage, staying there because his brother already had a place there. So we had three beds in this garage, and one of his buddies from New York just got out of prison, and so he ended up there somehow. I don't know who he was. And long story short, I went where the booze was. So I left at the hotel I was working at, took what I thought they owed me, and I went to Monterey with him. And because I thought it's party time. We worked with the carnivals all year long. All we did was drink and party, and I thought it's on. So I went down there, and they decided they're going to have this party. This guy who just got out of prison, he had me drive him to the store. It was a long story, I think. He went through the liquor department, filled up a guard cart, got one of those carts full of bottles of booze. Half gallons, quart, whatever it was. And so then I'm with him, and he just pushes it out the door and puts it in the car. He forgot to pay for it. So then he said, "Take me across the street." So we went over to the Safeway or whatever it was. He did the same thing. He didn't pay for it, but he filled up the cart. So we went to this. So we went back to the party, but before, so we're off anyway. So we stopped at a bar, me and my friend and his brother, and I pick up this gal. And I don't know. I guess she was only 18. I don't know, but she was in the bar anyway. And so I said, "You want to go to the party?" So the next day, he had the party going on, and you know, people ask if you want a drink or bought a glass of drink or whatever. They just handed you the bottle. And so at any rate, these characters came in that I don't know. They didn't work with us. I had no clue who they were. I guess they were all on drugs. But at any rate, they decided they were going to rape this guy I was with. And I said, "No, you're not." You know, and so this guy picked up a lead pipe and he swung it at my head. And naturally, I put my hand up there. So I hit my finger and I moved my hand. And that's all I remembered until I woke up. It was 7 o'clock at night and I'm laying on a mattress in the sewer floor of the garage with blood everywhere. And I had to pee. So I got up to go pee out the door, whatever. I couldn't walk. My bones was crushed in my right ankle. And I had pus and blood coming out of my head. And they said, "You're not going to know a doctor because they're afraid I'd tell them what happened. And then they'd go to jail or whatever." And it was 3 days later before they took me to jail. But this one guy thought I was dead, the one that just got out of prison. And he wanted to cut me up in little pieces and put me in a plastic bag and drop me off to the Monterey Pier. See, these are the kind of people I got involved with when I was drinking. And you know, like I said, I'm a lover, not a fighter. I don't like all this violence and stuff. But you know, that's why I say when my friends went out drinking, and I'm just so grateful to be here. I had a sponsor back in Indiana that when I had that 2.5 years in the program back there, he always said, I never saw a grateful alcoholic get drunk. And you know, I try to keep gratitude in my heart today. And whenever things ain't going right, if I get down in the dumps or I think things aren't going the way I think they should, you know, if I can just stop my mind from thinking for a couple of minutes and look at where I was and look at where I'm at today, I have no reason not to be grateful. I am so blessed, you know, and to have so many friends. Like I said about that, these people were talking at that meeting up there and where those 500 people was, I made myself go to them, and they were talking about the ones at the convention in Hawaii. I'm still picking up cigarettes off the ground. I'm envious. You know, I think, you know, I just wish it would happen to me, but I knew it would never happen. But you know, that's why I say if you just get in here and do what other people are doing, I don't know what's going to happen in your life. I know that I just started doing what other people were doing. I started getting involved. I got a sponsor up there. Actually, he got me. And then I got down here and I got Ivan. And then Rick and people are involved. People are in service. They're good role models for me. And I just keep doing what other people are doing that are staying sober. Then I have a chance too. You know? It's just amazing that I came down here and met so many wonderful people. And when I say I was envious of those people and I didn't know how my life was going to be, to be honest with you, I didn't even know where Vidalia was. I got married and my wife ended up with a job down here and I had to look on a map to find out where Vidalia was. And it's crazy. And that's another story too. I mean, when I tell you, you don't know what's going to happen in your life, but that's no lie. Because I came at that meeting I was talking about, those women were up there flirting with everybody, and they wanted the man just as much as the man wants a woman. And I used to go home and all by myself because I was too scared to talk to them, which saved my life probably. Because I always got in trouble with the women. So I'd go home and I can remember, this is a true story, I remember talking to God one night and I told God, I said, you know, as much as I'd like to have one of those women up there, you know, I'd like to have somebody in my life, I said, you know, I said, if I had somebody like that, I'd have to quit going to meetings every day, I'd have to quit doing this, and I couldn't do that anymore. And I said, but on the other hand, if I had a woman who would just be at home whenever I got home and everything would be fine, you know, and I said, well, you can't have your cake and eat it too. So I told God I'd just stay single for the rest of my life. And 3 weeks later, I met my wife. So that story. But, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love you people. And it's amazing the things that can happen if you just come in here and give yourself a chance. You know, I just wish I could give a little bit of hope to somebody who, like myself, had none when I got here. You know, people's lives do change. If you hang around here long enough, yours can change too. And you can see what other people are doing. You know, I not only went to that convention that these people were talking about, I actually been to it nine times in the last 10 years. I missed 1 year because I was in the hospital here sick, or I had my heart problem or something. But you know, I even got to experience living over there for about a year and a half. So you never know what's going to happen if you just suit up and show up. Things happen. I can't put into enough words the gratitude that I have for Alcoholics Anonymous. I try to stay in service, and that's how I try to show gratitude. I go to several meetings, and you know, people say that, you know, my home group is this or my home group is that. To me, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, is my home group because I try to stay involved with all the meetings I go to. I want to stay connected. And I think that's just about enough out of me. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and thanks for all of your support.